Luke 5:1-5:16. The 22nd talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 16, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're actually going to go to the Gospel of Luke this morning. I thought I would do one more topical thing, but I think I'm going to go ahead and jump into Luke. I won't be here the next 2 weeks, but I'll be here continuously after that. But we're going to go ahead and return to the study in the Gospel of Luke. And I don't have my handout and translation for you. I don't know if I'll be able to keep up with that. So you'll have to use your normal Bibles. We're going to look at chapter 5. How far? To about verse 16, I think, this morning, if we get that far. Now, this I'm reading from my translation. It may be a little bit different, but I don't think it'll be too bad. Now, it happened that while the crowd was pressing around him and listening to the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats lying at the edge of the lake. The fishermen had gotten out of them and were washing their nets. So he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little way from the land. And he sat down and began teaching the people from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch." Simon answered and said, "Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I will do as you say and let down the nets." When they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish, and their nets began to break. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat for them to come and help them. And they came and filled both the boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw that, he fell down at Jesus' feet, saying, "Go away from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For amazement had seized him and all his companions because of the catch of fish that they had taken. It was likewise with James and John, sons of Zebedee. They were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not fear. From now on you will be catching men." They consigned their boats to land and left everything and followed him. We'll stop there for now. Years ago, when we stopped Luke, we had seen all of the announcements, the prophecies, the comments by people under who knew the scriptures and who could articulate their hope for the coming Messiah at the birth of Jesus. There are several chapters in Luke where he covers that. And then you have his baptism by John the Baptist, followed by his temptation in the wilderness by Satan. And then he returns up to Galilee, and in Galilee he begins to teach in the synagogues and begins to get people's attention, and that's where we cut off. And this is the next thing after he kept preaching in the synagogues of Judea, as his pattern in his ministry at that point in his life, and then Luke records this account. Little background to this. Galilee, as I'm sure you know, is the northern part of what is today modern-day Israel. Along the coastline is a rather even, harborless strip of land that relatively narrow, that rises up into some hills, steeply up into the hills in lower Galilee above what we know as the Plain of Armageddon, until it reaches a height of about 2,000 feet. On the east of the hills is a rift in which the Jordan River runs and begins and runs, and it's actually below sea level. So the Sea of Galilee is a lake that's below sea level by about 260, 270 feet. The drop from the height of the mountains down into the lake is something like 2,500 feet or 2,600 feet. So it's a spectacular scene. If you've never been there, it's my favorite spot in Israel. And the climate down at the lake level is actually almost tropical because it's so low. To the north, to the northwest of the lake, the hill country rises to about 4,000 feet. And actually northeast of the lake is Mount Hermon, which is about 9,100 feet of a pretty relatively high mountain. The lake empties in, the Jordan River empties into the Sea of Galilee or Lake Gennesaret, and then continues on down the rift to the Dead Sea at the southern end. There are plenty of fish in the Sea of Galilee, and so fishing was one of the major industries. In fact, the fish from Galilee actually sometimes made their way all the way to Rome. They would catch fish for the day. They would catch fish to supply the local population. Anything that wasn't bought outright by the local population, they would salt it or smoke it and send it to Jerusalem and various other places, export it. Simon and his brother Andrew come from a little village on the northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee called Bethsaida, which is basically just a fishing village. They fish there. That's what they do. Well, Simon and his younger brother Andrew come from there. John and James have a father named Zebedee, who they apparently come from Capernaum, which is sort of the commercial hub of the northern Galilee, Lake Galilee area. Zebedee was probably a relatively wealthy man. He has boats, he owns boats, and he has hired servants, we know from the biblical accounts. And we also find out later that John is known by the high priest in Jerusalem. And if you know anything about the economic, political, social structure of Israel at this time, the high priest was always from the top aristocratic families in Israel among the Jews. So to be actually a family acquaintance of the high priest means there are some connections of some kind. So it's in all likelihood, Zebedee is a relatively wealthy and influential man in Galilee. He may even have land in Jerusalem. That's not clear, but he may have land in Jerusalem. And he has two sons, James and John, who are partners with him in this fishing business. Somewhere along the line, Simon and Andrew from Bethsaida, a few miles away, and James and John from Capernaum got together and formed a partnership and have essentially a fishing business with James and John's father, Zebedee. Fishing primarily, this was not recreational fishing, this was not sport fishing, it was an industry. So they would fish usually with nets, take their boats out in the water, oftentimes in the wee hours in the morning, or what he calls night here. In the wee hours of the morning, they would go out in boats and put a large net between the boats and just drag it to shore, and whatever they got, they got. Or, if not that, they would stand on the shore and throw smaller nets out into the water and drag them to shore, or even do so from the boats. Why is it called Lake Gennesaret? On the northwest corner of the Sea of, what we call the Sea of Galilee, is a plain that has, as the hills descend down, they descend down more gradually in the northwest corner into a plain called the Plain of Gennesaret. It probably comes from a Hebrew word ultimately. The Sea of Kinnereth was the older name for the Sea of Galilee in the Old Testament. And it comes from a Hebrew word which means harp, because from a certain vantage point, the shape of the Sea of Galilee looks like a harp, and they called it Lake Harp. There was a city built on that plain called Kinnereth as well, and by the time we get to New Testament times, that's been transformed to Gennesaret. It's the Plain of Gennesaret with the city of Gennesaret on the shore of the lake. And one of the older names for the lake then is the Lake of Gennesaret, which is what Luke uses. Okay, so let's look at the beginning of this in 5:1. Now it happened that while the crowd was pressing around him and listening to the word of God, he was standing by the Lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats lying at the edge of the lake. The fishermen had gotten out of them and were washing their nets. So he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little way from the land, and he sat down and began teaching the people from the boat. Jesus not only taught in the synagogues, but he also taught just itinerantly, going wherever he could find a hearing and begin teaching. That's apparently what he's done here by the lakeshore. The crowd, it says, are pressing around him and listening to the word of God. Because they must be pressing around him and listening because they're having difficulty hearing. So Jesus decides to go out into a boat where he can be better heard by the crowd. So he sees the fisherman not using his boat, asks him if he will take him out into the lake, and he stands or sits in the boat in the lake and teaches the crowd on shore from the boat in the lake. It says, listen, they're listening to the word of God. I think what Luke means by the word of God simply comes from a larger picture that we get from the apostles. You know, John probably states it most explicitly. Jesus is the light of the world. That the role of Jesus is to be God's spokesman, God's final and last prophet, God's spokesman, to come into the world and tell mankind what this is all about and what's going on. And that message from the Father, from our God, that message from God to mankind, conveyed by the Son of God, Jesus, is God's word to mankind. His story, his account, his rendition of his purposes and our place in history and what our destiny is and what this is all about and how we get there. All of that constitutes the word. So I think it's a broad term that would incorporate all kinds of teaching. Teaching about what the prophets had to say in Israel, the history of Israel and the significance of the history of Israel, and how Jesus himself fits into that, and what that's going to mean for the nation of Israel, what that's going to mean ultimately for the Gentiles one day would be included in that. Whatever Jesus explored as he took people to the scriptures, the Torah, would have been, I think, the word of God. So he was teaching these things. They were wanting to hear him. That, as we will see by the end of this thing, the crowds at this point in Jesus' life are totally intrigued by this man, what he's doing, what he's capable of, and what he has to say. They seem to be completely enthralled by him. So they're listening to him. He asks to be taken out so that he can be heard more. And it's Simon whose boat he takes. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch." Simon answered and said, "Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I will do as you say and let down the nets." Now, the way this reads seems bizarre to us. And I think the reason it seems bizarre is because if we don't have a historical context for the gospel accounts, we only have the accounts themselves. And the accounts themselves are incredibly abbreviated and incredibly truncated. There's a lot that we don't know if all we have to go on is this one account here in Luke. For example, we don't have the account that we have in John's gospel, where we understand that Simon and Jesus are no strangers to each other by this point in their lives. At some point, Andrew, who was... Did I tell you that Simon had a brother, Andrew? Simon and his brother Andrew came from Capernaum. Andrew and Simon both, and apparently John from Capernaum, had heard about this dude, Jesus, down south on the River Jordan baptizing people and saying some different things, and they decided to go investigate it. So in the opening chapters of the Gospel of John, they're not in Galilee. Andrew... John and Simon are down listening to, I'm sorry, did I say Jesus? They're listening to John the Baptist baptizing it along the Jordan River. So they've gone down to listen to John the Baptist several miles, a number of miles away. And they are there when John the Baptist sees Jesus and declares him to be, "Behold, the Lamb of God slain before the foundation of the world. This is the one who we are looking for. This is the one who was to come." And they have heard John the Baptist identify Jesus as the Christ. And they have then been so bold as to introduce themselves to Jesus and interact with Jesus. Then we also have to remember that something we can get here from the Gospel of Luke, that that this is not the first thing that happens in Galilee. Jesus has been going from town to town and doing various miracles, teaching in the synagogues, and has actually begun to create quite a stir in Galilee at this time. And this is no secret to Simon and Andrew and John and their brother James, who they have related this to. This is no secret to them. So when Jesus asks Simon to use his boat and to go out into the water, and then when he asks him to go fishing, even though he's been fishing all night and has been skunked, this is no stranger who's asking him this. Jesus has demanded, Jesus has gained and earned Simon's respect. And so Simon, although he's baffled by the request, it makes no sense to him as an experienced fisherman. So even though he's baffled by the request, he has enough respect for Jesus, the person, that he's just going to go along with it and do what he says. Presumably, I don't fish, so I don't know, but presumably conditions are sometimes good for fishing and sometimes bad for fishing. And Simon has been fishing all day and got nothing, which suggests that the conditions just aren't right for fishing. So from an experienced fisherman's point of view, it absolutely makes no sense for him to go back out into the water and start fishing again at this particular point in time. But Jesus asked him to do it anyway. Then he says, when they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish, and their nets began to break. Now, Simon and his boat partners had gone out in the one boat, and they let down some kind of net. Probably it's not a drag net that would require two nets. It's probably just a single, what they call a skein net. But they catch such a large haul of fish that it's beginning to break the nets and ultimately begins to sink the boat. So they have to call for the other boat that's been left on shore to come out and help them. They signal their partners in the other boat for them to come and help them. And they came and filled both of the boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw that, he fell down at Jesus' feet saying, "Go away from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." Now, this is a very strange response, I think, and yet it's a very profound and significant response. And I think in some respects, I think this is the heart of this account, getting the point of his response here. Simon is not a tax collector. He's not a traitor. He's not a robber and a thief. He's not a prostitute. He's not any of the things that you would typically think of in Jewish society as a sinner, as what you would describe as a sinner. That may not be altogether true. I mean, because he's probably not a Pharisee. So he's not a participant in that movement to restore Judaism to righteousness and obedience until Messiah comes. So he may not be a righteous man in that sense, but he's a decent, ordinary Jewish middle-class citizen, maybe even upper middle-class citizen. And we have every reason to think that he's a decent man. And yet, at this event, he cries out, "Get away from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." The point being, I think, he's recognized something in Jesus that makes him feel that he's not worthy to be in his presence. So he's saying, "You don't want to be around me, Jesus." That's what he means by "get away from me." "You don't want to be around me, Jesus, because I am not worthy to be in your presence." Apparently, the miracle was so, the supernatural, what strikes him as a supernatural event, convinces him that Jesus has some kind of authority that people don't normally have. Either he had the authority to make this happen, or he had the authority to predict that it would happen, but either way, this is an authority that people don't normally have. And he recognizes that this kind of authority means that there's some kind of divine appointment that Jesus has that your average person doesn't have. And to be divinely appointed by God to some specific goal and role is to be holy. And Peter's own self-concept is, "I'm not worthy to be in the presence of a holy man. So you don't want to be around me, Jesus." Well, what does he mean by that? "I'm not worthy"? we don't naturally have that perspective about ourselves. I mean, what Peter is saying isn't anything different than what you and I should be saying as well. But we don't naturally have that perspective. Our natural perspective is, I'm basically just fine. We can make a list of all the things we haven't done that other sinners out there have done. All those things we've avoided, all the ways in which we've kept ourselves good and righteous and pure. And that's normally what we fuel our self-concept with. But Peter, in contrast to that, is keenly aware of his shortcomings, all the ways in which he has not done what God expects a human being to do, all the ways in which he has not been what God expects a human being to be, all the ways in which he has not had regard, what the Bible calls love, for God, for his Creator, and has not sought to submit his life and his existence to the reality of that Creator. He's keenly aware of all of those realities. Well, that's a remarkable act of both courage and humility to come to that point. What comes more naturally to us as human beings is that kind of self-defensiveness, that self-deception, even self-delusion, where we rationalize all the evil of our lives and perversion of our lives, and we recite to ourselves all the acts of charity and goodness and kindness that we have done and declare ourselves a good boy. And that's what comes naturally to us. So it is very significant that Peter, already this early in his relationship with Jesus and already in his odyssey here, is able to articulate able to respond out of a self-concept that I am not worthy. Because that's going to become central to the Christian message. That's going to be central to the gospel message. It's not the only truth of the gospel message, but it's one that is so foundational that we dare not miss it. And that is this coming to the truth that my self-concept, if it's going to be in touch with reality, needs to be a self-concept that I am a sinful, perverse human being who is not worthy. And if I don't get that, then nothing of Christianity can possibly make any sense. I have to begin with that insight and that truth. That seems to be where Peter is starting. Okay, go away from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. For amazement had seized him and all his companions because of the catch of fish that they had taken. It was the supernatural nature of this catch that had got his attention and had impressed him with the holiness of Jesus. It was likewise with James and John, sons of Zebedee. They were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not fear. From now on you will be catching men." Okay, what "do not fear" also strikes me as an odd thing to say, because it wasn't that he was afraid. He was just keenly aware of his unworthiness. What does he mean by "do not fear"? From now on you will be catching men. I think what he means is do not fear to be in the presence of me. Do not fear to be in the presence of one holy, in the eyes of God. Do not fear to be in a relationship or an association with me. Your unworthiness does not disqualify you from being my disciple, ultimately, is what we're talking about here. Your unworthiness does not disqualify you. A very important and profound point, again, because how often have we in our lives just felt too unworthy to be able to call ourselves Christians, to call ourselves disciples of Jesus, to claim that I follow Jesus, to desire to even follow Jesus? I think it's a very normal human experience that we have, that this is way beyond us. This thing that we're all a part of is really too much for us. And that's true. We are unworthy. We're not disciples of Jesus because we're great specimens of spirituality. We're not disciples of Jesus because somehow we've, you know, climbed up the spiritual ladder and attained great heights of spiritual success. We are, all of us, if we're honest with ourselves, miserable failures at being human beings compared to what we know a human being ought to be. Compared to that and by that standard, we are all unworthy. And our natural impulse is going to be just like Peter's. Get away from me, Jesus. Don't let me sully you. You don't want to be in association with me. And so for Jesus to come back and say, don't fear, and to reassure us, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not embarrassed. I'm not ashamed. I'm not about to disassociate myself from you, is another way of articulating the good news, the gospel itself, that God is not above condescending to associate with us losers and failures and sinners. And that's what he's saying to Peter. In fact, he goes on to say, I'm going to make you an integral part of what God has sent me into the world to do. You're going to play a role, an indispensable role, in accomplishing God's purposes in the world. And he says that by saying, from now on, you will be catching men. Now, I think we can greatly misunderstand this, because if you're like me, mostly what I'm familiar with from far away is sport fishing, not industrial fishing. And in sport fishing is a very different gig. In sport fishing, you use bait and you try to entice the fish to choose to come and take the bait and be captured by you. But in the sort of fishing that Peter does, no fish are choosing nothing. They're just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and you just snatch them up and they're yours. So for Jesus to use this analogy of you will be fishing for men, that's the kind of fishing he has in mind, is that Jesus recognizes that that's what reality is all about. We are a school of fish swimming in the cesspool of a world. And God's purpose is to simply cast his net into this cesspool and snatch some of us out of it for his purposes, to keep for his own, to belong to him, and to use according to his purposes. That's very much the picture of the apostles. So when he says, you will be fishing for men, he's saying, you, Peter, are going to have a role to play in that divine project, that divine fishing project. You're going to help God in the process of snagging out a haul of fish for God. It's very consistent with many of the other metaphors that you find in the New Testament. We are gifts that the warrior Jesus has captured on the battlefield that he's taking back to God to give to God as gifts, to belong to God as to serve God as his slaves and his servants. We are booty that the robber Jesus has taken when he's broken into the stronghold of Satan and taken out of his treasure house that which belonged to him. I mean, that kind of metaphor is really pretty frequent in the New Testament. Well, this is right in keeping with that. God is not ultimately asking anybody any permission to do anything with them. He's just decided to make us victims because we were in the wrong place at the wrong time. He's decided to make us victims of his grace and his mercy and just turn us into godly, God-fearing servants of him. But Peter, he says, is going to have a role to play in that, even though he is unworthy. Sure, he's unworthy. We're all unworthy. But Jesus is not ashamed to be in association with him, and in fact, he's going to give him a role. Now, this next part in 5:11, I'm retranslating this. I hope I'm right. Take this with a grain of salt. Maybe I'm not right. I think the New American Standard has taking their boats to shore or something like that, taking their boats to land. They left everything and followed him, which leaves the impression that if you had a video camera, what this would look like is you would see Peter and the other boat bringing their haul of fish in, dragging their boats up onto shore, and then dropping everything and walking after Jesus. I mean, that's how it sounds like the video camera rendition should go. But if we read Mark's account and Matthew's account, that's not consistent with that picture. So I think the problem is a translation problem. I think that the translators of Luke have misconstrued what Luke means by this particular verb. And landing their boats is not landing their boats, but rather, and I don't have a word for it, maybe some of you can help me with this, but at some point they decided to, I mean, if it were soccer, I'd know what you'd say, that they're hanging up their cleats. If it was tennis, I'd know what to say, they're hanging up their rackets. I mean, but you don't hang up a boat. I don't know what you do, but they're dry docking their boat, or they're storing their boat, or they're warehousing their boat, or whatever you do with boats, they're doing that with their boats and leaving everything and following him. I think 5:11 is not happening immediately after 5:10. 5:11 is the ultimate result of this encounter that Simon has with Jesus. Because actually what happens where they follow immediately is at a later point in time, I think, they are fishing from the shore, Simon and Andrew and John and James, and they're casting their nets into the sea, and Jesus comes walking along the sea and says, "Follow me," and they drop their nets and follow him. And then he goes a little bit further to James and John and says the same thing, and they follow them. It's a different account. And I think the reason that's different is because it happened at a later point in time. This has been preparatory to that. He's told Peter, "I'm going to make you fishers of men." A number of days later, he comes and makes the invitation, and they follow. But even then, again, remember, I mean, the first time I read this as a child, I just thought, this is ridiculous. If some stranger comes up to me while I'm fishing and says, "Drop your fishing pole and follow me," like I'm going to do it? I mean, it just seems so weird. But that's not what's going on here. They have heard him teach. They have been fascinated by his teaching. They have grown to know him and respect him and love him. And he's finally coming to say, I'm going away. I need a band of disciples to come with me and learn from me. Will you be one of them?" That's in effect what he's asking. And they have decided yes. And so when the time comes that he says is leaving, they can at that point literally drop their nets and follow him. Okay, that's that event. Let's do one more. "While he was in one of the cities, behold, there was a man covered with leprosy. When he saw Jesus, he fell on his face and implored him, saying, 'Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean.' And he stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, 'I am willing, be cleansed.' And immediately the leprosy left him, and he ordered him to tell no one. But go and show yourself to the priest and make an offering for your cleansing, just as Moses commanded, as a testimony to them. But the news about him was spreading even farther, and large crowds were gathering to hear him and to be healed of their sickness. But Jesus himself would often slip away to the wilderness and pray." Okay, we have a man covered with leprosy. First of all, notice that he says, "while he was in one of the cities." I think that's pretty interesting and pretty significant, and it gives us some insight into Luke and his work as a historian. Luke seems to be very cautious in recording his events. If he doesn't know exactly what city it is, he doesn't make it up. I mean, I don't think anybody makes it up in the Bible, but my point is it becomes very clear that he's unwilling to make it up, because he's very clear there was a certain city, I don't know which one, essentially, is I think what's implied by that. He knows the region. He knows roughly the time in which it occurred in Jesus' ministry, but his research has not allowed him to get to the bottom of where exactly it happened. And for that reason, he has the integrity to simply tell you what he does know and not pretend like he knows more than he knows. So in one of these cities, and we are situated in the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee, basically, and around the northern rim of the lake, but in one of those cities, there was a man covered with leprosy. Leprosy seems to be a term that was used. It's not a medical diagnosis. It's not a scientific diagnosis of a condition. It's not like something, the symptoms being caused by a certain kind of bacteria or fungus or virus or whatever. It's not that kind of diagnosis, because their medical knowledge at that point was not really, strictly speaking, scientific in its nature. it was what a philosopher would call phenomenological. That is, there's certain symptoms that have appearances that manifest themselves in ways that are similar to one another. And the question is not, do you have a disease caused by this virus? The question is, do you have the kind of symptoms that look like this? As a consequence, there are many different skin conditions that would go by the name of leprosy. Some of them were totally benign. They wouldn't be called leprosy if they're benign. Some of the skin conditions were benign. Some of them were fairly malignant, some of them even fatal and deadly. So if someone had some of these symptoms, the question was, which sort was it? Was it benign or was it more malignant? Was it psoriasis or was it Hansen's disease? Hansen's disease is ultimately going to kill you. Psoriasis is just not very pretty. So which was it? Well, way back into the Mosaic Law in the Old Testament, there was prescribed a procedure for determining which sort it was. Was it benign, in which case it was not leprosy, and not being leprosy, you were declared clean? And we'll talk about that in a second. If, by watching it, the priest determined that the symptoms increased and got more severe, then he gave a different diagnosis. This is leprosy, and the person was declared unclean by the Mosaic Law. Well, this person is covered with leprosy, so apparently it has become apparent either he has been declared so by a priest or simply the course of the disease has made it apparent that this is not going away and this is not benign. This is what we call leprosy. Well, he's covered with, literally full of leprosy in the Greek. So he's in a very advanced stage of some kind of condition that's pretty serious. Leprosy, by the Mosaic Law itself, and then you add to that the rabbinic tradition that makes it more severe, was a completely and totally socially debilitating condition. If you were a leper, you were the outcast of outcasts. You know, just think in terms of the way the Jewish life was structured. It was centered on the religion. If you couldn't participate in the religion, you couldn't participate in the community. You couldn't participate in their culture, in their society. According to the Mosaic Law, if you had leprosy, you could not enter any house. If you had leprosy, indeed, you had to live out what they called outside the camp. That is, you couldn't even live in the city. If you had leprosy, you were to declare as you walked along, unclean, unclean, as you walked along, to warn people that you are coming, lest they accidentally bump into you. Because, at least according to rabbinic tradition, and arguably according to the Mosaic Law, although it's not exactly explicit, but arguably you could make a case from the Mosaic Law, that if you accidentally touched a leper, then you became unclean. So as they walked along, they had to shout out, unclean, unclean. People would become afraid of them and would basically completely and totally shun them and ostracize them. I read an account about a modern-day problem of leprosy, and the doctor was saying the biggest problem with leprosy was the psychological damage, because the people felt so incredibly isolated. And it was not uncommon for lepers to commit suicide, not because the disease was that bad, but because the social ostracism was just intense and totally had this incredible traumatic impact on them. Well, that's the kind of man we're talking about here. This is a man who is a complete and total social outcast in his society. So while he was one of the cities, behold, there was this man covered with leprosy. When he saw Jesus, he fell on his face and implored him, saying, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Now, he fell on his face, I'm sure, as an act of submission and humility and subservience. But he implored him, it says, saying, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Two things are noteworthy about this. He has no question about Jesus' ability. That's not the issue. I know you can. The issue is your willingness, not your ability. Well, that already indicates a certain significant level of understanding of who Jesus is. He's watched this man, Jesus. He's watched what he's been doing, and he is utterly and totally convinced that he has a kind of divine authority that would give him the ability to heal him. But he says, if you are willing. It's very tempting at that point to make that a theological claim, but I think that would be to misunderstand what's going on here. I mean, if we understand the nature of God's sovereignty over reality, we recognize that there's so many things that we pray, not everything, but so many things that we pray where they have to be, Lord, if it be thy will. Lord, if you will, if it is within your purpose, if it's within your plan, then let it be this way. And we know to pray that way because that's just simply theologically accurate. That's how else can we pray. I don't think that's what this man is saying, though. It's not in view of the sovereignty of God, I recognize that it may not be his purpose to heal me, and I'm willing to bow to that and submit to his purpose. But if by any chance it is his purpose, I could use some healing. That would be true, and that may very well also be his attitude, but I don't think that that's what this language is communicating. I think what this language is communicating is his own self-concept as an outcast. No one else in his society is willing. No one else in his society gives a rotten fig what happens to him. No one else in his society has any regard for a leper. A leper is someone I didn't mention, but in the rabbinic tradition, why did you get leprosy? There's one of seven sins that could lead to your being cursed with leprosy. This was not organic. This was the judgment of God. So they had every reason to feel justified in their own fantasy, in their own deception, feeling justified in forsaking the leper and leaving the leper alone to his own misery. So I think that's the experience out of which the leper is speaking. He's hoping against hope that this same man, Jesus, who has a unique authority and a uniquely divine appointment from God, might also have a unique set of values and a unique perspective and a unique willingness to show compassion where no one else will show compassion. And I think it's in that hope against hope that he's asking. It's basically a test of Jesus. Who are you? What makes you tick? What's important to you? What's valuable to you? Are you, when all is said and done, just like everybody else out there? And that's why I think we get this response from Jesus. I am willing. It's an incredibly profound and poignant comment by Jesus. I am willing. It's basically Jesus saying, yes, I am not afraid of reaching out and touching the outcast. I am not afraid of showing exactly the same regard for the outcast that I would show to anyone else. I am no respecter of persons. Social status is of absolutely no consequence to me. Social latitude, social value, what's valuable in the eyes of other people, makes no difference to me. That's not what makes me tick. That's not how I look at the world. You are a creation of God, whom God loves no less than anyone else. And of course I'm willing. It's an incredibly poignant and profound comment, I think, by him. What's even more significant is that he reaches out and touches him. I mean, you have to remember, if you touched a leper, you became ritually unclean. So Jesus is saying, I'm even willing to become ritually unclean in order to heal you and to cleanse you from your uncleanness. It had to speak volumes to anyone who was present and anyone who witnessed this. The argument in the commentaries is, did he break the law? Did Jesus break the law here? Well, First of all, we have to understand that there are a lot of things that made you unclean that you had no control over. I mean, in Deuteronomy, if you're walking through a field and you come across a dead body, you're unclean. What do you do? I'm sorry, God. I'm sorry the body was there. I mean, it's not your fault. To be unclean is not the same thing as to be disobedient. To be unclean is not the same thing as to be evil. To be unclean is strictly a liturgical category. It just means you're not going to get to go into the temple for 7 days or however long it takes to be cleansed from it. That's all it means. Now, if that lasts for a lifetime to not be able to go into the temple like the leper, that's significant. But it's only an inconvenience if you have to wash your clothes and light incense and cross your fingers twice and twirl around 3 times and wait 7 days. Then okay, then you just do that in order to make yourself clean. But you just make yourself clean. Jesus doesn't mind being inconvenienced if that's what's going to happen in order to heal him. And this becomes an incredible metaphor, I think, for Jesus' whole life and Jesus' whole ministry. What he's doing to the leper here is exactly what he's come and done for us. He was willing to become unclean in order that I might be cleansed. And now we're not talking about liturgical uncleanness, but moral uncleanness. As the apostles see it, Jesus took on himself the sins of the world. Jesus took on himself my sin, my uncleanness, in order that I might be rendered clean before God. So this event here is just a foreshadowing of what his whole life was about, to come into the world and take on my uncleanness that I might become clean. He could have healed him by just speaking a word. That would have been a piece of cake. He didn't need to touch him. It's not like the energy needed to flow through his fingertips. You know, leper cleansing energy only comes through fingertips. It's nothing weird, bizarre like that. He could have spoken the word. He could have told him to go slap some mud on his face and wash it in some sort of pool. I mean, there's any number of ways he could have done this, but he touched him, making himself unclean. That's why I think this is intentional and significant. He says, immediately the leprosy left him, and he ordered him to tell no one, but go and show yourself to the priest and make an offering for your cleansing, just as Moses commanded, as a testimony to them. Now again, it's tempting to think that when he says he ordered him to tell no one, that this is a part of a pattern that you see, especially in the Gospel of Mark, not so much in the Gospel of Luke, but a pattern that you see in the Gospel of Mark where he keeps telling people, now don't tell anyone that I did this. But I don't think this fits that pattern. I don't think he's saying, don't tell anyone that I did this. I think what he's saying is, go and do what the law says. When he says, don't tell anyone, I think what he means by that in this context is, don't tell anyone until you've gone to the priest. I think at that point he would say, you can tell anyone you want to after that. But the first order of business is to go and show yourself to the priest and make an offering for your cleansing just as Moses commanded. So one, it's out of respect for the Mosaic Covenant. I want you to do what the Mosaic Covenant says to do in these circumstances, because what the Mosaic Covenant says to do, certain kinds of leprosy will go away on their own. It depends on what it is. But certain kinds of leprosy will simply disappear. They'll heal themselves. And when that happens, the Mosaic Law prescribed what you needed to do. You needed to go to the priest, have the priest confirm that the leprosy is now gone and that you are clean, and then you became ritually clean by washing clothes and offering things, and there's some prescribed ways that you made yourself ritually clean then. So Jesus is saying your first order of business is to go show yourself to the priest, have him confirm that you are now cleansed of the leprosy, just as Moses commanded, and then offer the appropriate offerings so that you can be ritually clean. That's what you do first. He says, as a testimony to them. I think what he has in mind is, let's make this as much a testimony as we can. Don't just leave it to you, to your word, that you used to have leprosy and now you don't any longer because somebody named Jesus touched you. Go to the priest and have it officially acknowledged and recognized that you are cured and that you are cleansed. that will be further confirmation of the reality of this miracle that you've just witnessed. And that will be the testimony to them. Even the priest himself has to acknowledge that, yes, this occurred, this happened. So I think what he's saying is, don't just spread this as a rumor without confirmation. Do exactly what the law of Moses commanded, and then that way, when the report goes out, it will be a confirmed report, confirmed in keeping with the law of Moses. Okay, then finally he says, but the news about him was spreading even farther, and large crowds were gathering to hear him, and he healed, and to be healed of their sicknesses. But Jesus himself would often slip away to the wilderness and pray. Two things I want to say about this. One is, I think Luke's point here, and the reason he has this in the account, is to try to give us a feel, a picture of what's going on at this particular point in Jesus' ministry. The pressure is mounting. He has been wildly successful at this point in getting the attention of the Jewish people. And so much so that word is spreading throughout the whole region, and people are traveling significant number of miles to come and hear him teach and bring those who are ill to him to be healed. And there's just more and more and more people, and probably very crushing crowds at times, who are surrounding Jesus, and all of them wanting what he has to offer, wanting his attention. Now, if you just let Jesus be God, you know, no big deal. But when you remember that Jesus is a human being, and, you know, put yourself in his shoes, this has got to be incredibly stressful, an incredibly demanding time of his life. And I think that's what Luke is trying to say in this passage here, is that this came to a point of real stress for Jesus. How did he handle this stress? Jesus himself would often slip away to the wilderness and pray. Now, I want to make one comment about that, and then I'll open it up to your questions. A statement like this in the Gospels, and this statement in particular, is often used in our Christian culture to support our teaching about the need to have a disciplined prayer life. We look at this and say, see, Jesus prayed often. Therefore, since Jesus prayed often, therefore, we should pray, and then depends on the formula, every day or three times a day or six times a day or however many times a day. But therefore, shame on you if you're not leading a life of disciplined, regular, frequent prayer that you simply discipline yourself to do, because that's what spiritual people do. Jesus did it, and so you should do it too. But that's to totally ignore what Luke is doing here, and to totally ignore the context. Why was Jesus praying often now? Well, first of all, I don't think the emphasis really is on the praying here. The emphasis here is on the slipping into the wilderness to get away from the crowds. That's the emphasis, not on the praying. Now, what did he do when he was there? Well, he prayed, and that's not unimportant. I think that's important, but the emphasis is on him slipping away into the wilderness. That's what's correlated with the crowds. I mean, you can pray with crowds around. That's not going to stop you. But what's unique in this situation is him going away and slipping in the wilderness to get away from the stress. Because that's how stressful it was. It says he did it often. Why did he do it often? Because of the time of life that he was in. Because he often needed it. He's responding out of his spontaneous need for peace and quiet and rest and some serenity, because whenever he goes into public, it's a madhouse for him. And so he does it often because he needs it often at this point in his life. Notice that it makes no sense to look at this as a discipline, because Luke is clearly tying his going into the wilderness to pray with the size and chaos of the crowds. He's linking them together. If he wanted to make the point that Jesus was a right disciplined prayers pray by the clock, not by the crowd. They pray according to the schedule, not according to the need. They pray spontaneously as the need arises, disciplined people don't pray spontaneously as the need arises. They pray whether they need it or not. But Jesus here is being described as responding spontaneously out of a need that has arisen in his ministry. So whatever else we make of this, this is not a justification for our theology and our mythology about prayer. Okay, let me open it up for your comments and questions.
I was just curious, you were talking about how Jesus actually wanted people to know about this thing. He just had to go tell the priest first.
Yes.
As far as, I don't know if they just used conjunctions oftentimes, so it seems like the "but" was, every time I read this, the "but" really sticks out, because, you know, he ordered him to tell no one, but news was spread quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that mean that he really didn't want him to tell anybody?
Well, it could be, and there are times where that's, I think, exactly right, particularly the accounts in Mark where he says that. I think it really would be his preference that he not tell anybody. But this reads differently to me because it's he ordered him to tell no one but go and show yourself to the priest. That is, what's the contrast? What's the alternative? He has two options. He can, in obedience to the Mosaic Covenant, go show himself to the priest and do the appropriate offerings, or he can go spread this story about what's happened to him. And I think what Jesus is saying is, do what the Mosaic Covenant says to do, not the other. But I don't think that, what I'm saying is, I don't think that in of itself implies that Jesus has any problem with this particular miracle being reported abroad. I don't think he has a problem with that. The ones where he has a problem with it later in Mark, and I haven't looked at this recently, but so this may not be true across the board, but they strike me as the ones that Jesus is afraid will be misunderstood by the crowds in the sense that they will interpret it as a sign that they need to rise up in arms against Rome and make Jesus king and throw off the Roman honky and get on with the kingdom of heaven here. And I think Jesus says, don't tell anyone at those points in time, because he does not want to prematurely bring about, he wants it to run its course and be tried and crucified by the authorities in Rome. He doesn't want a war to break out first. And I think that's why he's concerned about certain miracles that he does not being widely known.
In making the contrast with Peter's response to the big haul of fish, I wanted to contrast that when Jesus had the Sermon on the Mount and other sermons where the fish and the bread were flowing wonderfully and people were just saying, great, we're set for life. You notice that Peter didn't say,
yes,
great, Jesus, okay, you want to cut of the prophets type of thing? It was an entirely, I guess I could say, similar stimulus, but in an entirely different reaction.
Yeah,
to it.
Excellent point. Thank you. Yeah, that is very striking. Because what you see right here with the news spreading and large crowds gathering to hear him and to be healed of their sickness, although you can't read it out of that statement in itself, what you see as the story goes on is it's the being healed of their sickness part that they're most interested in. And that's what's so striking about Peter, is it's the theological significance of what he's just witnessed, not the economic advantage that has been granted to him, that is most important to him and most striking to him. Yeah, excellent point. Yeah.
I had a question about what you were saying towards the end about prayer. What do you do with verses like 1 Thessalonians 5:17, where Paul says, pray without ceasing, as opposed to pray when the need arises?
Okay. Well, if you'll notice there, and I'm going by memory here, so I may not get it right, but it's sandwiched between, in all things give thanks, pray without ceasing, can't remember the last one, but it's a gratitude sandwich there, if you go look at it. And so I think those three are intended to be taken together, to be understood, to be mutually interpretive. He's not simply making a statement, pray without ceasing. What he's saying is, I don't care what kind of circumstances you find yourself in. If you're in pain, if you're in grief, if you're in sorrow, or if you're completely delighted and giggly with joy out of something that God has blessed you with, I don't care what the circumstances are, gratitude is the appropriate response to God. And so his first thing he says is, in all things give thanks, pray without ceasing. Well, what he means by without ceasing is, when circumstances change, don't let the prayer of gratitude stop. Don't let the prayer of gratitude cease when the circumstances that you're now thankful for are no longer there. Because gratitude needs to be my persistent, constant, universal response to all of every circumstance of my life, if I really understand what's going on. Yeah, I think so.
Okay, when Jesus touches the leper, in this instance, do you think Jesus would probably go through the whole process? He's telling the leper to do what the Mosaic Law says, so he would probably go through the Mosaic Law to demonstrate to others that he thinks there is value in, there's some value in the Mosaic Law. But also Jesus knows that that's not really, those actions aren't important. So at other points he's going to show others this isn't very valuable. But do you think this is the what would Jesus do of this?
Yeah, yeah.
In this aspect he would probably go through everything and take the time to do that, wouldn't he?
That's my guess. My guess is that he probably did consider himself unclean after touching the leper and went through the appropriate procedures, which as I recall are not that demanding. I think it just means you wash your clothes and then you are unclean until sundown or something and then you're clean. So it's not really that big a deal. But my guess is that he would have actually done that. Now he may not, because as I said, it's not all that clear from the law that touching a leper would make you unclean. There are passages that says if you touch an unclean thing or person, you are unclean. But the question is whether those are to be read contextually. That is, if they're unclean for any reason whatsoever and you touch them, are you unclean? Which is the way I think is the right way to take it. But they are in particular context, so you could argue that if they're unclean for this reason, or this reason, and you touch them, you're unclean. And it would be a question of what's the right way to understand that. The rabbis certainly had understood it, that if you touch a leper, you are unclean. But when you touch someone and they're being cleansed from leprosy, are you touching them before they're unclean or after they're unclean? I mean, before they're clean or after they're clean?
Well, and can Jesus be unclean, really? I mean...
Right. Well, I think he could be ritually. I don't think that's a problem. I mean, I think he could be ritually unclean. But the other possibility is, just like he interpreted the Sabbath day, he asked the rabbis at one point, if an ox falls into a pit on the Sabbath, which one of you doesn't help the ox out? It's work, isn't it? But you all recognize that there are certain values that have to trump other values. Jesus is quite ready to point out that you can't obey every instruction in the law completely in every circumstance, because every now and then you run into circumstances where the requirements of the law are in conflict with one another. What do you do then? And his answer to that is, You have to make an assessment of which is the value of greater import, and you obey that. So, for example, he talks about David feeding his hungry, starving men with the showbread, which was only lawful for the priest to eat. But you also have a law that says love your neighbor as yourself. Okay, well, which of those has to take precedent? Jesus doesn't have any problem with taking the greater commandments as in obeying those, even if that means disobeying the lesser commandments. So he recognizes that the law is not one-dimensional. It needs to be intelligently and morally interpreted if we're going to really do what God asked to do. So he says it's not unlawful to work on the Sabbath if the work that you're doing is not your occupation and trying to take care of your livelihood and so on, but you're trying to save a life. That's not breaking the Sabbath, even though technically it might be breaking the Sabbath. It's certainly not breaking the Sabbath in the sense that God intended it. So I think he may have thought similarly, reasoned similarly, and argued similarly about this as well, that yes, technically you are ritually unclean if you touch a leper, but I wasn't exactly touching him in the sense that law meant. And so he may have decided that he wasn't really actually unclean, but I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me at all. In fact, I think it's probably likely that he went ahead and went through the ritual cleansing after this. One more.
When you were describing the prohibition against touching an unclean person, you only talked about the ritual uncleanness of it, that it's a hassle for somebody who's ritually unclean, but it's not a, you know, it doesn't seriously interfere with your life, and that the leper, when he was saying to Jesus, if you're willing, he's recognizing, or he's it, behind that statement is his experience of nobody else being willing. And I don't know if they knew this. I suspect they sort of knew that some kinds of leprosy were contagious. And I remembered I got a union newsletter that was talking about my union is pretty liberal, and so they have all the liberal knee-jerk issues. So anytime you come up against anything that looks at all like any kind of discrimination, they're going to scream. And there was what I thought was a perfectly absurd article in there talking about the history of the leper colony on, I believe it's Molokai, that was started by Father Damien. And it's real leprosy, Hansen's disease. And it was talking about how the history of lepers, how terrible it was for them, and, you know, nobody would hang out with them, and, you know, they were ostracized and outcasts and that kind of thing, and sort of talking about it in the same way as you would talk about the history of black discrimination, you know, that they had their own water fountains and their own bathrooms and their own restaurants and that kind of thing. And it struck me as being very absurd, because while I can think of actually no justification for racial discrimination, it was only recently, when tetracycline was invented, that Hansen's disease actually had a cure. And before that time, basically, if you got leprosy, Hansen's disease, you could pretty much count on your body parts gradually falling off, and then you would die. And it was very contagious. Well, it was contagious, and they weren't really sure exactly what the vector was for the contagion, because you could have a member of your family having leprosy and the rest of the family would never get it, and one chance encounter with somebody on a street and you could get it. So it was the consequences of coming into contact with a leprous person could be really substantial. So I guess my question is, there's Father Damien, who started the leper colony in Molokai. I don't know if all this is true, but he had he apparently had a great heart of compassion for these people. This was before there was any cure for Hansen's disease. And I believe, I heard a story at one point when he was looking over this guy in the last stages of Hansen's, and he was just suffering so tremendously, and his heart was so moved for compassion for this guy's not only physical situation, but his social situation, that he actually, I guess, kissed him or somehow deliberately ingested some of the noxious stuff on his skin. I don't know if that's what caused it, but I believe Damien actually finally got leprosy and died of leprosy. And I guess there's a part of me that says if people avoided a person with leprosy knowing that it was potentially contagious and life-threatening, it seems like that I wouldn't necessarily call that evil or unrighteous or whatever. That, in fact, Jesus, I'm guessing he was not putting himself at risk by touching the leper like an ordinary person might. So I guess what I'm asking you to talk about is that in some situations, what may be a common sense sort of taking precautions, okay, my friend has the flu, and you know, I need to decide whether I'm going to expose myself to her flu when I go over to bring her some chicken soup, or to what degree am I just going to say, oh, God will protect me, so therefore I will give my friend a hug and comfort her, even though it's, you know, that that's not the way God usually works. God usually works to not give us a disease by having us take commonsensical approaches to avoiding it. So how do you, it seems like there's not a simple way to think about that. There's not a, you should never, it's always unkind to avoid a sick person, and therefore you should always expose yourself to any and everything in the name of kindness and God will take care of you, versus you should never expose yourself. This is a, you know, you're acting consistently with God's way of doing things. You should be commonsensical. That's a righteous way to approach and just avoid exposure to a sick person. So how do you put that together?
Yeah, I don't think there is a simple way. I'm not even sure that the right thing is going to be the same for every individual. We have our own individual responsibility and calling and walk with God that we need to be obedient to. And I think we're just going to be making judgment calls about how great is their need versus how big is the risk for me and weighing that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being commonsensical and pragmatic and taking steps to protect myself. I mean, one of the other things we could raise from this is, what about leaving their occupations, their boats, their nets, and walking off and following Jesus? Another way that you read that when you're reading the Bible for the first time is that this is this great act of faith of total and complete rashness and irresponsibility. And what the Bible is teaching me is the rasher and more irresponsible, the better, you know, the more faith that it is. But again, that's a function of not understanding the nature of this genre and how we are to understand this. The historical reality is they had time, and in all likelihood they did, take care of their families and prepare to go on this experience with Jesus. They left wife and children behind. They had servants. I mean, Zebedee had servants. Zebedee didn't go. He probably still ran the business, and they were probably the rest of the family was on board, both be willing to maintain the family and take care of the family while these guys went off with Jesus. It was a family that was a family of certain means as well. Maybe they had the means to be able to take some time off. I mean, they weren't acting rashly and irresponsibly, I don't believe. I mean, there's nothing to suggest that they were, and there's everything in the Bible that would suggest that would be unloving and ungodly and unrighteous. So by the same token, with respect to your question, there's nothing wrong with doing everything we can to be responsible for my own safety, for the safety of other people around me, for the sake of other people around me, to be responsible and commonsensical in the way I interact with people, on the one hand. On the other hand, sometimes there comes a point where another person's need is so great that I might need to take risks in order to meet that need, because no one else is going to do it.
So let's say you're Father Damien, and you're being a priest, being a Catholic priest, you don't have a wife and children. You can take risks like this. Nobody else is doing it. These lepers need taking care of. He could have gone either way. Does God whisper in our ear to say, okay, this is very risky, but I want you to do it anyway? Is that how we know?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay, how do we know?
We just make that decision however we make that decision, and by God's grace, it will be right.
Okay.
I've kept you over. I need to let you go.